We need to make prisons smaller and safer so that inmates don't have to turn to gangs for protection.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with David Scarbeck. He teaches political economy at King's College in London, England, and he's the author of the great new book, The Social Order of the Underworld, How Prison Gangs Govern the American Penal System. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Talk a little bit about how governance emerged in prisons, because this is a place where, you know, the prisoners know they're not going to get any help from the guards, and they have all sorts of reasons not to interact with them. There was, in your book, you talk about the period before the 1950s when prison gangs rose up. What was it like before prison gangs, and then why did the gangs emerge, and how do they govern things?
Yeah, well, one of the fascinating things that my book looks at is prior to the 1960s in California. And it turns out if you were incarcerated during that time, one of the most important sources of safety or regulation in your life would be not gangs, but something called the convict code or the prisoner's code. And it was just kind of a basic set of ideas about what's acceptable behavior for inmates. Don't lie, don't steal, don't incur a debt and not pay it back. Right. Be a good neighbor to other people.
And how was that enforced? Like if somebody, you know, somebody contravenes of what happens?
In a very decentralized fashion. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't an organized monitor trying to find out when people broke these rules. The more that people broke them, the more likely they were to be ostracized. That would mean that they wouldn't have access to resources, support from their peers. It would mean that we were more likely to be victimized by other inmates. Mm-hmm. And that provided some pressure or incentive for inmates to kind of do what other inmates hoped and expected and wanted them to do.
Okay, and so then, you know, through the 50s and into the 60s, that changes. What drove the change, and then what happened?
The major change is the increase in the prison population. So for this convict code to work effectively, other inmates have to know who you are, and you have to know who other inmates are. But as prisons get larger and larger, the prison population goes from fewer than 5,000 inmates up to 25,000, and subsequently, you know, substantially more. There's more strangers around you, and that means that that ability for a decentralized system to work works much effectively.
And of course, everybody is wearing the same clothes, so they, you know, you can't even really distinguish people by, you know, most physical appearances. But that gives rise partly both to gangs who then organize and racial gangs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the 1960s in California, there's dramatic increases in inmate-on-inmate violence, many more stabbings and assaults. And that reflects the fact that the code is less effective at providing the safety and order that inmates want. So what we see when we study the history of gangs, so prison gangs like the Mexican Mafia, the Aryan Brotherhood, and these notorious groups, when you look at their histories, they all form to provide protection and security and safety to their own members. So in the 1960s and 70s, they're forming because as an alternative source of governance to this convict code. And as populations increase subsequently, these gangs take on even more important roles.
And one of the reasons that race is important is because, again, when everybody's dressed the same, that's one signifier where you can guess, okay, if you're white and you see another white guy, they're on the same team. If you're black and black, you're the same team, Mexican.
The way that the gang politics, as they call it, works is it's effective at doing what inmates want because you don't have to know a particular person. Mm-hmm. You just have to know which group they affiliate with. So without a doubt, there's racist prison gang members. I don't want to deny that.
Yeah.
But there's a logic to it in that in an environment where everyone wears the same clothes, they have similar haircuts, they're in a roughly similar age, what's the easiest way to identify what group someone affiliates with? Well, the color of your skin is very low cost to identify. And that makes that interaction between members of different groups much easier to govern.
What happens if you know, and you see this in shows like Oz and whatnot, or, you know, prison shows, if you're white and the Aryan Nation gang comes along or something and say, hey, you got to join us, what happens to the people who choose not to?
Yeah, well, I mean, in California, the affiliation that you have to make isn't typically with kind of one of the traditional prison gangs. It's just with a broader racial group, the white inmates, maybe from a certain geographic area. Mm-hmm. As long as you're willing to affiliate to that limited extent, then that's good enough. If you're not willing to do that, sometimes inmates affiliate with religious groups or sports teams. But what's key to each of those groups is that each member of the group is responsible for every other member's actions. So when there's problems, everyone knows who to go to try to control you.
Talk a little bit about tattoos as well, because this is, you know, it's a flourishing industry or practice in prison with rudimentary tools, but how do tattoos function and what are they?
Prison is an environment where there's lots of strangers around you. You don't know who's trustworthy, who's dangerous, who has a good reputation, and who has a bad one. Tattoos are a way to provide credible information. They're permanent, they're often prominently placed, so you're not just going to get a tattoo on your face or your forehead indicating that you have some past experience or affiliation if you haven't. Because if you did, you couldn't very easily hide it. So it makes some great, very credible signals of information. And in a world of so many untrustworthy people and strangers, they're especially important.
And this is, they show up, you know, at the hands, above the neck, et cetera, right? Because the whole idea, I mean, it might be, you know, if we get drunk and we go to a tattoo parlor, we get one on our butt, that's the last place you want a tattoo in prison, right? You want it to be visible.
The more visible it is, the more information it provides to strangers, and the more easy it is for other people to know what that information is you're trying to convey.
What was driving the increase in the prison population in the 50s and 60s?
Well, I mean, a variety of different factors. The big increase in the prison population comes later in the 1970s and, importantly, the 1980s and 90s, and that's because we're incarcerating people for longer, we're ramping up the drug war, prosecutors are prosecuting more of the cases that are brought to them. So a variety of different factors all contribute to this big boom. And as you know, I mean, the United States locks up more people than any country in the world, and that's driving or creating the foundations for the importance of prison gangs today, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you say to minimize prison gangs or the need for prison gangs, we've got to minimize the prison population.
Prison gangs are not ideal. Nobody wants these to be the main source of order in prison. They don't practice accountability, equality, rule of law, anything like that. So if we want them to be less important, we need to make prisons smaller and safer so that inmates don't have to turn to gangs for protection.
Are you optimistic about prison reform efforts going on now, particularly sentencing reform? You see people like Rand Paul and a bunch of other politicians really moving forward, it seems, on sentencing reform.
It seems that there is an interest and an emphasis from both sides, from both parties, to support criminal justice reform in ways that will reduce the prison population. One of the benefits of doing so would be to undermine the power of these gangs.
How did you get interested in kind of studying this issue? I know your doctorate's from George Mason University. Talk a little bit about the experience there and how that played into this book.
Well, the main practical interest is simply the fact that the U.S. is an extreme outlier in how many people it locks up. And I think that it's crucial that we understand what is life like for those people. But the second, kind of more broader academic point, is to understand how do people engage in social interactions? How do we trade? How do we interact with other people when there's not a strong, effective government overseeing and facilitating that interaction? And ironically, in prison, a place that has lots of government action, there's actually a strong sphere of autonomy in there. So the goal is to understand, in instances where the state doesn't provide the governance that inmates want, How does it form? How does it look? What does the governance and life look like in those situations?
And what can we take? What are the lessons that we learn from there that we might apply elsewhere?
The nice lesson is that even for people who are kind of less educated, have less self-control, are most likely to get into trouble, even amongst them, a very high level of economic activity can take place. The downside, however, is that these are people who are, they can't exit, they can't leave the community, they don't get to choose who they interact with. And those are two powerful ways that people develop cooperative relationships in other settings, and they're absent in the inmate setting. So I think really what it shows is that those are especially important, and when we don't get those, the forms of governance that we have aren't something that we can really get excited and thrilled about.
I guess final question: what's your recommendation for a great movie or a great movie or TV show that explores this dynamic?
Yeah, well, there's actually two great movies that have been made on this. One is the American Me, loosely based on the Mexican Mafia prison gang in Southern California. And another film is Blood In, Blood Out. Anyways, both of those kind of capture very well the prison gang element and the informal element that exists in many American prisons today.
Well, thank you so much. David Scarbeck of King's College, London, the author of The Social Order of the Underworld, How Prison Gangs Govern the American Penal System. David, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.